Dear audience, welcome to another podcast episode from HST. My name is Barbara John, and I do have a guest this afternoon, a very special guest. It's Robin Turner, General Manager of Roche, Czech Republic. He's an Australian-British national who has worked in 8 countries on 3 continents, and he has been in Prague since 2016. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
When a couple of weeks ago I received the announcement of your early retirement, I was quite surprised. Why now? Is it now the right moment?
I hope so. I thought I'd been working since I left university, so 40 years, and 36 of those have been in Roche, as you said, in a lot of different jobs in different continents, in the last bit more than 4 years here in Czech. And I think, you know, the job that I set out to do here was done, and I started to think it was about time to think more, have more time for family, for friends, and for hobbies, and to have the opportunity to travel. And of course, with COVID, it's not so easy to travel as it was before. I can't just pop on a plane and go and see what I think is called now my atomized family, 5 kids scattered around the world. I need time to do it. So, no, it felt like the right time. The organization's really on a good track. And it was time. Simple as that.
It sounds wonderful. And I'm sure some of our people listening will envy you a little bit.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, if you can finish your career feeling, well, I've achieved everything I wanted to achieve. I've got nothing I feel I have to prove to myself or to anybody else any longer. I've done a great job. And I'm handing over a business in great shape. I think it's a very positive way to end your career rather than, you know, somebody saying to you, Robin, don't you think it's about time? you know, yeah. So I took the choice. It was 100% my choice. Fortunately, the company supported me in that decision. And off I go. End of November. New adventures, new life, new country again as well, to Sweden.
Oh, great. Sounds really nice. And so I really have to take the opportunity to talk to you and to find out about your secrets, how to be so successful and how to be able to retire at such a young age. So maybe we should start with looking back.
Mm-hmm.
You started your career with Roche. Today is one of the largest biotechnology companies in the world, originally from Basel.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I'm imagining how young Robin entered the offices 36 years ago. I mean, you must have been in your 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in my, I'm 61 now, giving away my age. So yeah, my early 20s. I had a lot more hair than I have now, and it was brown in color. I was probably naive, enthusiastic, but very open-minded. And just getting on with starting a career, really, not knowing where it would take me.
Yeah, what were your expectations at that time?
A monthly salary, enough money to feed my passion for dinghy sailing. I was basically an almost semi-professional dinghy sailor, earning money to pay to feed my sailing habits. So my main concern was I had a salary and a car to tow my boat around, if I'm really, really honest about it. That's how it started.
Okay.
So that was my expectation.
At that time, you were working in which country?
I started in the UK, actually, interestingly enough. I'd sort of grown up there and done my university education. And that's where I'd sort of fallen in love with boats and the water. And that was what was really driving me at that time. Of course, it was, you know, somewhere a career was in my mind, but it wasn't formative in top of my mind, for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, when I see my children now in the 20s, they have also different expectations at that age. You're not thinking about the end of your career. It's just having a good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
yep.
What kind of company did you encounter at that time? How was Roche? I mean, I can imagine it also changed. I mean, you lost your hair, but maybe also the Roche changed a little bit.
No, it was radically different. I would have said in the 80s, Roche was a very Swiss company, very traditional in many ways. Nearly all the managers were Swiss. There were a few Germans and French who'd sort of probably originated as Grenzgangers into Basel. It was also a very different business model. We had a whole range of different businesses from perfumes, fragrances, vitamins, bulk vitamins, vitamins generally, the range like Barocca and Supradin that's now with Bayer. Pharma and diagnostics, yes, we seem to make a lot of money investing on the money markets. And I think I would describe Roche as a conglomerate that didn't really know where its focus laid. Obviously, a huge company, it had been number one in the world, in the pharmaceutical world with Valium and the benzodiazepine generation. But when I joined, it was basically, I would say, not in decline. Yeah, actually, sales-wise, in decline. And in the UK, funnily enough, Roche didn't have a good reputation. We'd been caught up in all discussions about pricing and scandals and whatever, and had become a bit the bad boy of the industry. So I was really amazed when I left the UK and started traveling around the world that everywhere else Roche's image was so positive.
That was a nice change for you.
Yeah, I mean, although I've always fought for the underdog, so it's never really bothered me that much. But yeah, I mean, as a company, it was still focused heavily on innovation, which it still is. It was obviously the family-run business that it still is. It still has, and it had then, a very strong focus on people. And I would actually say, in its way, quite a humble organization that was open to learning from its mistakes and moving on. So that was the company as it was then. Some of the traits have continued, but our business is radically different now. We focus just on pharma diagnostics. We've divested all the other businesses. We're the biggest investor in innovation, research and development of all the pharma companies. We spend about 11 billion Swiss francs a year on that. And globally, of all companies, we're the eighth largest investor in research and development. So it's very different. Most of our products when I joined are in the area we would call primary care, sort of general practitioner type products. And we've totally changed that. And I had no clue at the time, but when I went to Basel in 2001, I was head of the global primary care business. And the conclusion was we should get out of this. It's not a sustainable business model based on our R&D. So I actually talked myself out of a role, really, and recommended to Franz Humer, who was the CEO at the time, that we get out of primary care. He threw me out the office the first time. He continued to talk afterwards, and the decision then registered that it did make total sense for the organization, but radically different. And when we went off as a company focusing only on specialist products, hospital products, most of the industry thought Roche was crazy because that model had never been seen before. But we've proved it, and as you said in the introduction, we're the world's largest biotech company by a long way. We have an amazingly innovative portfolio, and we are not present in the GP sector really anymore at all.
Mm-hmm. So you really personally contributed significantly in the changes of the company during your career.
At that level, I think the biggest role or the biggest influence I had was obviously when I was in Global, but you know, we have a very decentralized, unique business model as well, where the affiliates have massive autonomy. And so you do get to have a big influence in the countries that you work in and that you lead as well. I think it's one of the real strengths of Roche, honestly.
So this was one of the challenges that you liked when you then became general manager in a country?
What I like about the role especially is the autonomy you have. I say to people often, it feels like I'm running my own business, but I'm backed by a large Swiss bank with a very good R&D portfolio. And you have the opportunity to really think and plan long term, which is quite different to particularly, I would say, American firms. I had 3 years in a US firm before I joined Roche, and the thinking there was very much more short term. Roche is still long term thinking about the way it approaches the business. And as a GM, you really get to shape that, run your own business essentially.
So you think that's a Swiss culture, a company culture?
No, it's a Roche company culture, because if I think about something like Novartis, the countries don't have any degree, anywhere near the same degree of independence. There's a lot more regional controls, regional people involved. In Roche, basically, it's the GM, this is the strategy. You agree the targets with your head office, and then you get on and do it. And I don't have to go back always asking, can I do this? Could I do that? I want to invest this. Here's a detailed ROI. If me and my team think it makes sense, then we get on and do it. It means we can react very quickly to our customers and to situations.
So you built up your market in Denmark, as I understand. You were in Denmark and in Portugal, and then you came to the Czech Republic.
Yep. So three very different places, different business challenges completely. I would have said in Portugal, I was almost a debt collector. They were in the middle of the, when I got there, in the middle of the crisis, the crash from late 2000s. And P stood for the P in the pigs country. The P was unfortunately Portugal. So, different jobs, different requirements. And that's the fun of it and the challenge, I think, as well.
What situation did you meet then when you came to the Czech Republic? And what were your main goals?
We had, unfortunately for my predecessor, we had a major morale issue and a very high turnover of staff. We also had quite a few market access issues in terms of actually getting funding for our products, because this is a 100% state-run system here. So the main challenges were really to rebuild the organization and the morale, and to ensure that we were getting access for Czech patients to medications, which was a process that was stalling at the time.
And I understand you succeeded, so that now you can retire.
I think that's about the summation of it. I mean, you can always do more. You're always going forwards. But, you know, we could see I came here late 16. By the middle of 18, the organization had really turned around. Our customers, importantly, were feeling the difference. Our market access problems were vastly diminished, and we were getting medications through to Czech patients much faster than was typical here in the Czech Republic. The organization is continuing to evolve, but it was on a really good track. And I just thought at the time, I could stay for my final year of my contract, or I could see if Basel would be happy if I stepped aside and let somebody else in. And discussion went in a good way. So, 30th of November, off to new adventures, a happy man.
Excellent. I would like to come back to this theme about building up an engaged team, a motivated team. Mm-hmm. This seems to be your strength. And I also remember one of our HSD events when we were talking about the topic flex or fail, about the future of workforce, or you said at that time that you were a strong believer of work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you are very demanding also towards your employees, and you expect really engaged work and have high goals. And on the other hand, you say, no, private life is very important. We need to have fun at work. How is it possible to realize this?
I think the first thing is, you know, you should, yes, you set high standards and you focus on getting results, but I would never say to my employees, and when they join us, I give 100%, I expect you to give 100%. I know a lot of GMs will come and say, I want 150%, or I want, you know, something extraordinary. I don't. I expect everybody that pulls their weight, does what they need to do. And that means sometimes we have to work a really long time, long hours, and other times we can do less. But at the end of the day, you know, you have a family as well as a job, and you need to get the balance between the two. And, you know, people often end up, I think, wasting their time. I call it fiddling at the edges, you know, trying to make something perfect that doesn't need to be perfect, and spending hours and hours on, you know, let's say messing around with a PowerPoint presentation, importing clip art and goodness knows what, when you just need to get a few basic facts communicated. So I try to encourage people to use their time thoughtfully, to focus on the things that can make an impact, not to be doing things that are ticking boxes rather than actually delivering something concrete. And I, you know, I've always tried to lead by example myself doing that. I think it's important. I also really say to people, work should be fun. If it's not fun, we're in the wrong job. We spend too much time working not to enjoy it. So I've always pushed that as being something, as one of my philosophies as well. Enjoy what you're doing as well. Otherwise, find something else to do.
That's very true. And do you think it's something that works everywhere in the world? I mean, you have been in very various countries, various continents. Yeah. Do they understand that everywhere? Is it the cultural question?
That's an interesting question. I haven't been everywhere, but I've been in 8 countries, and it seems to work there. In those countries. I'm not sure if I went to Japan and espoused those theories, whether they would understand me or relate to it. But I also look at it, and when I pick where I'm going, if I can see it's probably not going to be a viable option, I won't go there. So I've actually turned down a job in Japan. I turned down a job in the US because, again, I want to take more than 2 weeks vacation a year. So I've also, to an extent, made clear choices where I think my philosophy, my way of wanting to do things can work.
Okay. So you have a responsibility towards your team. You have a responsibility toward your employees.
Mm-hmm.
Big companies such as Roche, they also have worldwide big responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
How does Roche, for example, help or take its responsibility to improve the healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, we really want as a company to exist in a sustainable system where we're seen as a partner in finding solutions, where we're not seen as greedy big pharma trying, you know, to make excessive profits. Yes, we're profitable, but we're also highly innovative. And I always say, if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, companies that innovate do well. Companies that run out of innovation disappear slowly over time or get taken over and absorbed by more successful organizations. So we are focused on doing everything we can to create a sustainable healthcare system. As a company, we're also very heavily focused on sustainability, not just of healthcare systems, but sustainability in general. And only a week or so ago, it was announced that for the 11th time, Roche was number one on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index list of companies. So it's really finding a way that we can bring our medicines to the market, we can help patients with them, but we can do it in a way that is also supportable by the country that we're making them available in.
So what are the major aspects for the sustainability?
Finding an affordable value for money price, obviously. And that may mean in some countries, particularly the poorer ones, not enforcing patents or really reducing prices substantially. We would like, in a way, to be able to price our medicines in each country based on some sort of metric like GDP. Unfortunately, the parallel trading of pharmaceuticals makes that almost impossible. So you give a low price to a country, let's pick, for example, Romania, and the parallel traders then go and sell that product into Germany and take the profit. It doesn't help actually the system. It doesn't change the pricing really in Germany. It just makes the middleman that does the trading rich. Mm-hmm. And that's allowed under EU law. So that's just an example of where, you know, to some extent, legislation ties our hands. But, you know, we try to find, and we've been doing it here in Czech Republic, solutions which are, you know, practical and affordable and fit into the budgets of the countries that we're in. So that's really the main focus. And of course, our research and development is highly focused on innovative medicines that really make a difference, on trying to find personalized approaches. So we call it personalized healthcare, where we find, using, for example, genomic profiling, a medicine that's best suited to the particular problem that the patient has. So again, this is a win-win. The patient gets the drug that works. The payers only pay for those ones which work normally. And we're better able to target the medicine to the patient.
So talking about that, that means also this discussion about using of the big data, shared data, and the protection. Does Roche take its responsibility?
Big data, and I missed the last, sorry.
And the protection of this data.
Yes. I mean, you know, I think big data, AI, automated intelligence are, you know, ways we can really develop and deliver sustainable healthcare solutions in countries and tailor, as I said, you know, the medicine to the patient. For example, we run genomic profiling tests, which in itself isn't unique. What is unique is that these tests are linked back into a global database from those tests,
which now has several hundred thousands of patients and growing rapidly. And it helps us, for example, in cancer to find medicines which work in rare tumors, rare forms of disease. And often that means it's products which have a mode of action that makes sense logically, but has not been necessarily fully studied. But we look for results, we look for publications. So a patient runs this test, or is had it run for them by their physician. The data is sent through to the data bank. We look at the profile of that particular patient and tumor, try to link it back, and then we can come back with suggestions for a combination of therapies or a therapy that may work. And it may be it's actually a breast cancer drug, but due to the tumor mutations, it's actually going to be very effective in, say, colorectal cancer. And I think this is a very exciting way forward, I think, and offers huge possibilities to better treat patients.
Mm-hmm. Does this way of reacting also have influence now during the COVID-19 situation? Do you apply the same system for...
It does indeed. I mean, I think what we've seen with COVID is, you know, products being identified as possible treatment candidates using AI. Very rapid identification of some products, several of them have actually turned out then in clinical trials to look highly promising. I think also what we've seen though with big data is we need to do more across borders, because if I look across Europe, it sounds ridiculous, but we can't even agree on how many patients have died of COVID. Did they die of COVID? Did they die with COVID? In the UK, have they died within 28 days of diagnosis? Because if it's day 29, they didn't die of COVID. You know, unless we get better, and there are initiatives at the EU level now, unless we get better at being more consistent in the way we gather data, we miss a huge opportunity, I think, to understand diseases better, to develop treatments faster, to maybe accelerate research and development programs to help patients. Mm. And I think also it's digital, it's not really big data, but we've seen how digital has been accelerated by COVID. Whether it's remote consultations with patient and physician, whether it's the way as we as pharmaceutical companies interact with physicians, huge changes have been, you know, come out of COVID.
It's true, and in a very short time. Otherwise, we would have discussed these issues for years, maybe, and now we just had to react in a couple of months.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's been positive for the pharmaceutical industry because people, I think, better understand now how, you know, what the challenges are to develop medicines, vaccines, that it's important that we have large controlled studies in the end to actually ascertain whether a small sample in Poland or somewhere of patients treated or Italy really translates into a genuine benefit when you start treating thousands of patients. We had one such product in there, which everyone was very enthusiastic about, but we decided to run a very large global study. Again, it went very fast, but the conclusion was it's not very beneficial. So we stop, and then the search goes on for something else. But I think, you know, the public is starting to realize, and also governments and probably regulators, that the healthcare industry has a huge part to play, and that we really are partners, and, you know, we can accelerate processes when we all work together. You know, we're talking about reviewing a vaccine in weeks that would normally take years. And I guess the question then comes, why then for, you know, a treatment for a cancer that has a high mortality rate, why do we spend years again? Why can't we apply the learnings from that and accelerate what we do in other areas also?
So you think it will change also different studies, not only now in regard to COVID?
There's a lot of studies running still. There's obviously the vaccine studies, which get all the highlights, but a lot of studies running with antibodies, combinations of antibodies, other ways to suppress the immune system overreaction that's seen in the severe cases of COVID. So there's a huge amount still going on, and it will be needed, I think. I don't think, unfortunately, we're going to eradicate COVID. It will probably be better controlled. It may mutate, which may mean the whole vaccine thing has to start again. Or we might just somehow get very lucky like with SARS and it disappeared, but I wouldn't count on it.
Anyway, I think there's still a lot to do in pharma industry.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've found a lot of cures and treatments, but there's endless amounts of things still needing to be done, yes.
Absolutely. Anyway, I would like really to thank you also at this moment. I would like to thank you also for your support at the HST, at the Chamber of Commerce, Switzerland, Czech Republic, during your time in Prague. Your contributions at our events were always very appreciated, and it was good to hear about your immense experience.
Just thank
you very much. Last question, maybe. How do you see the position of Chambers of Commerce today in this world that is so global and we learn to connect virtually? I mean, I haven't seen you all year live, only online.
You saw me out at the radar and the, treatment facility, but once, and then COVID came in. Yes.
Exactly.
The laser, not radar, laser facility. Yeah, I think it has an important place to a role to play. I think networks are crucially important and, you know, should continue to be so, whether they go across national boundaries or they are, like with the Swiss Chamber, across industries, different industries, but with shared common interest, in this case, Switzerland. But I think it's a great opportunity to meet different people from different backgrounds, to share experiences, to talk to local Czech leaders, and to try to understand better the culture and the business environment. I think they have a really important role to play. It just needs an enthusiastic membership who really invest in those things. And the links into the Swiss Embassy as well, I see as being really, really important. So, no, I'm a full supporter of this and the opportunities that it brings to all the companies that participate, I think, and the individuals.
Thank you for the positive feedback.
Pleasure.
You are the fifth GM of Roche Czech Republic, from what I understand from the history.
Mm-hmm.
Can you already tell us who will be GM number six?
Not quite yet. I'm hoping in the next week or two that will be decided. They are going into final rounds of interviews now. But it may be announced before I leave. If not, as I've said to my boss, you know, once you've announced and you've chosen, I'm not far away. And in this virtual world, it's very easy to then try and hand over all the relevant information and things I can do to help my successor to get up to speed quickly. So I'm leaving Roche as a GM and employee, but I continue as a very well invested shareholder of the company, and I want to see the company continue to succeed.
That sounds very nice. Thank you very much, Robin. We also hope to keep in touch somehow virtually.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Let's see. The world is very small these days, and I'm quite sure I'll be coming back to Prague to visit on my commute between Sweden and Switzerland anyway. I can go a little out of my way to come through Czech Republic. And we have friends here. We actually have, my wife has some relatives here as well, because she was actually born, although she's Swedish, she was born in Czechoslovakia. We have quite strong connections to the country, which we want to keep up.
Very good. So all the best for your next step, for the next chapter. And thank you once more.
Thank you so much.